Welcome to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast, presented by 13 Fishing Canada. Make your own luck. We're here to scratch that angling itch and talk everything fishing. Join us as we sit down with special guests from across the industry. Now, here's your host, Logan Lewis.
Welcome back to another episode of the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast. I am your host, Logan Lewis. I hope all of you are getting very excited for open water season. Don't mind my voice here, of course, right before I decided to record the intro and outro for this episode, I started to get sick, but at least it'll hopefully be gone by the time open water season comes here. So for today's episode, we have the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group here for about an hour. Lucky enough to get them for that time. We have Dr. Chris Summers, Julie Stewart, and Kat McCallum come on to talk about their Northern Pike tip-up study, as well as their Boundary Dam Reservoir study. It's two really interesting topics that you aren't going to want to miss. Tons of great information for while you're out on the water and stuff that you can actually apply to some of your fishing decisions as well. Before we hop into this episode, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsors as always. Presenting sponsor 13 Fishing. So many great items to check out as we near closer to the open water season. And even though it's April 18th and it's been snowing for 2 days, it's definitely time to start thinking about what gear you want for the new season here. I picked up a couple rods myself actually from 13 to get ready for the spring/tournament season. The Defy Gold line has been really good. I've got about three of those now that I've been running. And then I also picked up another one of their Blackout series rods. If you're looking for a setup that doesn't really break the bank but still performs really well, the Blackout line of rods and reels has been awesome. I can't recommend them enough. Check out all the brands and save yourself 15% at checkout with code WEEKENDWARRIORS. That's WKND Warriors to save yourself 15% at checkout. Next up, got to shout out the Saskatchewan Wildlife Federation. Get your memberships from your local branch and become a part of an awesome community. You get access to land, some insurance, and an awesome magazine are just some of the benefits to mention there. And also be sure to be entering your Master Angler fish, whether you're still targeting stock trout in the off season here, or if you're waiting for the regular season to start again. That's enough for me now. Enjoy this information-filled episode with the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group. There's tons of great information in here that you're not going to want to miss, and some stuff that can help you out on the water next time. I'm joined by not one, not two, but three guests today. We've got some of the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group here today. If you haven't already, check out episodes 31 and 32, where we had Chris Summers on a year and a half, 2 years ago, something like that. It's been a bit, but for everyone here, we've got Chris Summers, Kat McCallum, and we've got Julie Stewart here as well. I guess if you guys just want to kind of introduce yourself and what you have to do with the research group, and then we'll go from there.
Sure, I guess I'll go first. So I'm Dr. Chris Summers. I'm a biology professor at the University of Regina, and I started a research program that dealt specifically with fish conservation and management in Saskatchewan about 2016, so about 8 years ago now. And I continue to run that program here in the province and a whole variety of different fish-related research.
Who's next? Who we got?
Okay, so my name is Julie Stewart, and I actually just recently finished my Master of Science with Dr. Chris Summers.
Congratulations.
And something that's interesting, thank you, something that's interesting about how I entered my master's program is I actually never fished before in my life, never handled a fish, never anything, but became really interested in it from watching seminars specifically on fish research. Reached out to Chris. He had an ice fishing opportunity to do research, and I took it and loved it ever since. So my research was on the effects of catch and release in the winter, specifically on northern pike.
Awesome. Kat?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Kat. I am also a master's student with Chris. I am unfortunately not quite finished yet. I am still in the thesis writing stage, trying to get through that. But I joined the lab in January of 22, I guess. And my work focuses on the aquatic ecology of Boundary Dam Reservoir, which is a really interesting system in the southeast.
And quite timely thing right now, too, with lots of the anglers' questions and stuff. And I guess we've got the big dogs here now, Chris. Last time I saw you was at the Moose Jaw Youth Derby out at Buffalo Pound, and you had some first-year students with you?
Second-year students, yeah. Intro genetics students, yeah. So we like to spread it around a little bit.
So for people that haven't listened to episode 31 or 32 that we had you on a while back, can you just kind of give a brief explanation of what the research group is?
Yes. So as a biology professor, I run a research program through the university, and my general interest is in basically how humans and animals interact with each other. And there really isn't a better example in my mind of interactions between humans and animals than fishing. That's what it's all about. And so my program really revolves around conservation and management of fish. And within that, I would view there to be three pillars. So that we do work on catch and release science. So how to best catch and release fish so that they have the best chance of being, successfully released and contributing to the fishery in the future. We work on habitat use and, what's important for fish and how human activities might influence that. And we also work on invasive species, which are non-native critters that are brought into Saskatchewan and other parts of Canada, usually by people, and that they might have an impact on our ecosystems here. So those are really the three main research areas that that the group focuses on.
Awesome. And I guess I'll sneak in a viewer question here. Logan was wondering, how many fish do you guys typically tag a year? I know it probably varies depending on the tournaments and stuff you go to, but what kind of numbers are you looking at there?
Yeah, so in total, our tagging program started on a, I won't say large scale, but on a consistent level in 2017. And so in that 7 years, we've tagged just about 19,000 fish. So we tag several thousand per year, and that goes up or down, as you said, depending on the particular studies that we're doing. But the background level is probably about 2,000 to 3,000 per year.
Okay. And this might be a silly question, but have you begun to notice a correlation between the time spent and the, tagged fish that are being caught and reported? Like, do you notice, do those kind of go together?
Yeah. So the more tagged fish you have out there, the higher the likelihood that you're going to get recapture reports. Right. And that is definitely the case. I would say, though, that, of the fish that we have tagged, we've received over 2,500 reports back from anglers. So getting more than 10% return rate on the tags, which tells me two things. One is that Saskatchewan anglers are awesome because they take the time out to report. And that's, a fantastic resource for this kind of study. And the other is that a lot of our catch and release must be going at least reasonably well so that we can get fish coming back in.
Yeah, for sure. I'll have to grill my little cousin here. He, at the Buffalo Pound Derby, he caught what would have been the biggest pike and did not enter it, which I guess for good reason. He was worried about the fish. He didn't want to put it in the bucket and bring it over, so he just released it. So that would have been the biggest fish. So I guess good handling and conservation. But also the next week after that, he caught a tagged pike and didn't report it. He took a picture of the tag, but it was all with the LJ and stuff on it. And he sent me a picture of it. I was like, oh, did you get the tag number? He's like, oh, I'll figure it out after. I'm like, it's covered in algae. Yep. You can't look back at your picture and enter it. So just know there was at least one Buffalo Pound pike caught that has not been reported back to you.
Yeah, and I think that does happen from time to time. There are people either who don't know what to do in terms of reporting or for some reason don't want to take the time to report. And that's normal for tagging programs. But the level of apathy, for lack of a better word, is usually much higher. So in other jurisdictions in North America where they try to do voluntary tag programs, they don't work very well. They have to do what's called a high reward tag program where you pay people money to submit tag information. Okay. And of course, we don't have that money. So we rely on the goodwill of anglers and, everybody's common interest in what fish are doing to make the program work. And it does work. So like I said, anglers deserve a lot of kudos for that participation.
Oh, for sure. And I guess that would take me back all the way to probably the first time I talked to you. I caught the very first tagged fish I caught was a red tag. I don't think you do those anymore, but that one was a reward tag, right?
Yeah. So those were tags that actually belonged to the Saskatchewan Wildlife Federation and were part of a plan that they had to do some reward tagging programs that are sort of like the Great Northern Pike Festival in Nipawin, where you have pre-tagged fish and they're part of a lottery. But that never ended up coming to fruition. So I actually borrowed their tags to use in our first round of tagging on Buffalo Pound.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I got two nice lures out of it. So it worked out pretty good for me. But I don't know how many I've sent you now. I was lucky enough to catch one literally the day after doing the tournament there with you. It
almost took my rod down the hole. The reel got stuck on the edge of the ice and I could hear some noise. I thought it was bells, but I was like, I don't have any bells out today. And I go back over to my hole and sure enough, my rod's pretty well down the hole other than the reel and the butt end of the rod. And it turned out to be a nice little, nice, really healthy tagged pike. But it's always exciting. It's another little piece, whether it's the competition of a tournament or coming across a tagged fish, it just adds that much more excitement to it. So I'm trying to boost those Buffalo pound numbers because I know last time we talked, did you say it was the lowest recapture rate?
For walleye, it's okay. One of the lowest that we have in our study system. And I don't know what causes that. And I think it might be because the walleye do some mysterious things in Buffalo pound. And mm-hmm. so I think they just aren't caught at the same frequency. But for pike, it's one of our better sites because we focused a lot of our pike research there.
Right, for sure. It's a great pike fishery. And I guess kind of heading into the bigger picture, what's so important about winter with these catch and release studies?
Yeah, it's a great question. Winter is no man's land or no person's land, I guess, for research. And it's been ignored, I would say, for quite some time. In terms of understanding interactions between anglers and fish, and understanding what fish do in the winter. And the circumstances are quite a bit different. And I'm sure Julie will mention a few of these things, but think of the environment that the fish faces when you pull it out of the water in June or July versus when you pull it out in January or February. Mm-hmm. In terms of the temperature, the metabolic rate of the fish, sometimes the equipment that you use, all those things are quite different in the winter versus the summer. And we really don't have much information about how those differences contribute to variance in catch and release success. So basically, Right. Do the same things work in the summer and the winter, or do we need to make adjustments?
Yeah. And I guess with Saskatchewan, we kind of get both sides of the extreme, right? It's the minus 40 that some people are willing to go out fishing in. And then there's those plus 30 some days that people are also fishing in too, right? So it's got, I always look at it as two extremes. People might think, I mean, would it be fair to say that summer is probably better on average for the fish as far as when it's interacting with humans?
I am not sure. I actually would say that winter might be better because it's kind of counterintuitive. But when you think about how an animal responds to stress, when a fish or any other ectotherm, so the old term was cold-blooded, any kind of cold-blooded animal is cold, they don't really mount a stress response or an inflammation response in response to injury. And so they may actually be slightly better off in the winter. Okay. And that's also true for air exposure because their metabolic rate is so low, they don't need as much oxygen. And so they could probably tolerate the air exposure a little bit better. Right. As long as it's not minus 35 and their gill filaments are all freezing and their eyeballs are freezing.
And they're a snowman.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. So yeah. The other thing too is that it seems like catch rates are probably lower in the winter. So people catch a lot more fish in the summer. Right. So I think in general, the summer is probably leaning towards being the worst of the two.
Right. And I guess you wouldn't know, obviously, with the numbers of people fishing, but I'm guessing there's more people that are wetting a line in the summer than in the winter for the most part, too. I know you can visualize it sometimes a lot easier in the winter because you like, drive down to Buffalo Pound and you see shacks everywhere. And you're like, oh, there's tons of people out here, but you don't realize how many people are actually fishing every day in the summer, too. So that definitely could add to it. So I guess when talking about the winter studies, we're kind of focusing towards you now, Julie. Do you want to kind of get into what your research topic was? Kind of maybe a good high-level view of it and then maybe get into some of the specifics and stuff that you found. I don't know if Chris has any other suggestions there too, but I'd be very interested to hear more about it.
Scott Lake Lodge is the destination trophy fishing location of your dreams. 46-inch trout and 50-inch pike have been caught less than 15 minutes away from the dock. 100 fish days are not uncommon. Fish over 3 million acres of private water and over 500 miles of shoreline. Pair that with some of the best guides in North America and 5-star luxury accommodations. Scott Lake Lodge is a once-in-a-lifetime fishing destination. Check out Scott Lake Lodge on Instagram or Facebook to see what you're missing.
No, that's what we planned. So
there we go. What I was studying, as I mentioned before, were the effects of catch and release in the winter using northern pike as a study species. And one way that we wanted to do this was by using the specialized angling, winter angling technique of set line fishing, or otherwise known as tip up fishing. So we wanted to use tackle that you could purchase from any regular store like Cabela's or Canadian Tire. So what we did was we actually used the Saskatchewan Sportfish Research Group Facebook page to survey anglers to see which type of hooks they were most commonly using to target northern pike in the winter with set line devices. And it came back that the double treble quick strike rig was the most popular hook style. And then that was followed by the single treble and the triple treble quick strike rig. And then we just decided, based on the conservation benefits that have been found in previous open water studies, that we wanted to test out circle hooks to see if they had the same type of effect in the winter and on set line devices. So those were the type of hooks that we used. And one question that I wanted to look at was, how does hook type affect placement and injury of fish in the winter? So when you're looking at the hooks themselves, the treble, the quick strike rigs look very differently than a circle hook, and they actually had very different protocols. So at first, we applied the exact same protocol other than setting the circle hook when attending tip-ups. So quick strike rigs, as the name implies, they should be attended to quickly. And that was something that we really emphasized in my research. So when a flag was triggered on tip-ups, we ran to those tip-ups within 20 seconds before we set the hook on quick strike rigs or began pulling up fish on circle hooks. And what we found through this is that circle hooks have a huge learning curve that you have to overcome to really really catch and increase your chance of catching fish on these types of hooks. So not only when you purchase, So when you purchase circle hooks, lots of them may say that they are inline 0-degree offset hooks, but when you actually are using them, you may notice that there's a slight offset, and that offset can catch on any internal organs, and then they don't quite work properly, which the conservation benefit of them is that they are supposed to hook the jaw of the fish, which allows the angler easy access for dehooking, and that is in turn lower handling time, quicker release back into the water, so more ideal for catch and release. But when you're purchasing hooks and they're slightly offset, then that benefit is kind of taken away. So we actually had to manually adjust each circle hook so that they were perfectly in line 0-degree offset. And another thing is, when you run and attend a tip up that has this flag triggered, you can't allow just 20 seconds. It's kind of specialized as you have to wait, you have to see how the fish reacts to the hook and runs with it before you start pulling up a circle hook. So what we found was we had to allow the fish to fully engulf the bait, which was symbolized or shown by the tip up, the spool stopping completely, which you could see on the top, and then it running again. And that's what we used to just kind of decide that the fish had swallowed the bait. So once it had swallowed the bait, started running again, and it started spooling again, then we started pulling up the fish and just maintaining that constant tension. It seemed to work pretty well because most of our fish that were caught on the circle hook were hooked in the jaw, which is awesome when you are trying to get these fish back into the water as quickly as possible when catch and release fishing. Oh, for sure. And exactly, yeah. And another type of hook style that we used was the single treble. And this only has one treble on it. And we placed it so that the bait was still horizontal presentation to the fish. And because it was a quick strike rig, we attended it quickly, set the hook within 20 seconds, and started pulling it up. Now, with this hook style as well, we found that it hooked a lot of the fish in the jaw, which was awesome. But compared to the circle hook, it had a little bit easier of a protocol to use, making it more accessible to any angler of any level, which was awesome. Now, looking at the double treble and triple treble, so those multiple treble rigs, they caused a little bit of issues with foul hooking fish, especially the double treble quick strike rig, because it's able to freely move in that wide position. So you might get one in the jaw, but one in the side. And then you're going to be starting to bring up fish horizontally and having issues bringing them up the hole, and then it gets stuck and you might have to drill a second hole or use different tools to successfully land this fish. And then you're risking losing the fish or the equipment failing and breaking. So kind of funny, we actually nicknamed this hook the double treble hook, because it always,
I feel like that was a Chris suggestion. That's a dad joke almost there.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Come on. That was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just waiting for it. Double treble. Yeah. Perfect. And same thing with the triple treble hook. It was a little bit more rigid just based on its design, but it was still causing foul hooking of the fish externally, which just increases the dehooking time, increases handling time. When you're dehooking these fish on the ice in extreme cold conditions, then you're going to risk tissues freezing, gills freezing. So that's something that you want to avoid. Mm-hmm. So I guess based on my findings of my research, of my Master of Science research, was that the single treble quick strike rig was the easiest to use and allowed angler success and allowed you to catch fish with the most frequent jaw hooking and easy dehooking for the angler. And yeah,
there you go.
That was a big finding of this research in the winter.
Yeah, that's that. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that's interesting. No, I was going to say you guys must be some of the most, some of the anglers that pay the most attention to their tip ups. Because I know lots of people, it's like things slow down. It's been half an hour and people forget to look at the flags. And also, no, how long's that flag been up? So good on you guys for paying attention and trying to get there. Like, I guess because that's one thing that people don't realize. A big part of the research is keeping things as constant as possible, right?
Yeah, trying to standardize everything.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's as a guide myself, when it comes to dealing with pike, I like your findings because the less hooks, the better for my hands and stuff like that. So it's interesting to know that. And when it came to the triple treble, what did you guys find with that, if anything?
So it caught fish pretty consistent. Like the amount of fish that were caught on all hook styles were pretty consistent throughout my entire study. And my study encompassed about 3 field seasons or ice seasons. So that was great to see.
Okay.
The only thing was the triple treble was more frequently foul hooking fish. And that just makes it a little more difficult for anglers to handle them, as well as when they're coming up the hole, the angler risks actually clipping their hand on one of those hooks. So that's something we also want to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah, especially with all your winter gear on, you've got a lot more stuff to put a hook into. And then, yeah, it's just a pain, especially pike really don't like to be calm when they come out of the hole. Unless it's a big one. I found the big ones are usually pretty good. But especially when you're out on buffalo and stuff, there's lots in that, I would say medium size that just go buck wild as soon as they leave the hole.
Exactly.
So, no, that's good. That's good. I've seen lots of whether it's YouTubers or some buddies and stuff like that are doing tip ups. So many people seem to have gone to that single treble. I know the double seem to be a lot more popular, especially those like Northland, double treble ones. They seem to be really popular, and I've had ones that just break off one of them and I keep going single, and I've just kept it that way. Cause I enjoy that quite a bit more too. And I guess when you're comparing the single to the circle hook, if you're saying if you are strict enough with how knowing what you need to do with it, the hookup ratio was good as well there. But as far as ease for just the everyday person out there fishing, that's where the single treble
exactly.
comes in. Okay. Yes. Oh, that's pretty sweet. Was there any other anything that you didn't expect that came out of this study?
Yeah. So one thing that was pretty interesting is I was able to gather behavioral data on the northern pike under the ice. So what I did was attached GoPro cameras that were attached to helmet extensions and put it directly in line with the tip up line. So I was able to get an overhead view of the fish interacting with the bait, which was super awesome. And then I was able to look at the surface data, which we also think of like angler data, and compare directly to the behavioral information. So that was very novel and super interesting. And one thing that we thought before starting this research was that pike were going to be these aggressive, voracious predators that would just come in super hard, take the bait, run with it, be decisive. And turns out they are not like that at all. Mm-hmm. They are very tentative in the winter. They like to take their time, look at the bait, really assess it before they decide to strike the tip-up presentation. Yeah. And what was interesting with that is they actually treated all hooks the same way. So less hooks, more hooks, it didn't matter. They struck at the tip-ups at the same frequency, which was great to see that they weren't being selective based on that. They just ever so slightly, based on my research, struck at the more vibrant bait type frequently when compared to like darker colored. So smelt and hot dogs were just slightly higher than fish like herring and Cisco.
Okay. That's interesting. I know smelt's probably the most common one. I mean, you can buy them at every gas station, it seems. I like to buy mackerel or herring. You can't find herring in Moose Jaw's superstores, so I have to drive to Regina for those, which you tell someone who doesn't fish that, they might think you're crazy. But and then I do like the mackerel as well, but those mackerel are quite big. So that's nice to know. I think smelts just get overlooked by people who do this a lot because it's just kind of, oh, everyone uses those. I got to use something else, right? But and then you can't go wrong with the hot dog. I know biggest pike was caught 2 years ago at the Buffalo Pound Derby on a hot dog. So that's good to know. Maybe that might be cheaper bait option, actually, than buying herring or mackerel. So
And they last a little bit longer, a little bit better. They hold the hooks pretty nice.
Oh, and you could also have lunch when you're buying bait as well. So
exactly. It's a win-win.
You can't go wrong there. I mean, you could eat the herring or the smelt, but I'm not preparing those on the ice. So that's not happening for me. I guess, did you, Chris, have anything to add to that you noticed with the study?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, I just echo some of Julie's comments, but I think we had a really strong interest in the circle hook. And I think the conclusion that we took from it was that I think circle hooks would be great for very serious anglers who put in a lot of hours on the ice and who are willing to undertake that time to get over that learning curve and get a good feel for how the circle hooks are supposed to operate. Whereas your weekend warrior type angler, you know, to steal the podcast name, might be better off with something that doesn't require as much nuance. And I think that's where that contrast with the quick strike rigs comes in. From a bigger picture perspective, you know, the idea behind the triple treble was that if you give the pike a big giant chunk of metal, they're not going to be able to swallow it. So they're going to get hooked in the front of the mouth. And that's going to be a positive thing. And that indeed does happen. But then you got your other treble hooks that are kind of waving around in front of the fish. And that's where we see some of the problems that happen. So you get different philosophies for different hooks. The circle hook is supposed to go down deep, get swallowed, and then come back up and turn the corner to go in the jaw. The triple treble is not supposed to go in past the beginning of the fish's mouth. And the hooks largely work as they're supposed to, but it's just whether or not the angler has the patience and the skill, or the patience to deal with some of these things. So, and I got to say that I was really, really surprised that pike don't just rush in and engulf bait on a tip up. And I can't think of a reason why they would want to be so selective and tentative about biting. I mean, this is a top predator. It's a still bait. I can't think of what they're worried about or what they're assessing when they're sitting there. You've probably seen them on camera, flaring their gills and waving their fins and taking forever to decide whether they want to bite or not. And, I'm just fascinated by what the decision-making process might be. Like, what are they actually
It's interesting because I've got footage on my underwater camera from, say, last mountain where we didn't have a single flag all afternoon, but I watched multiple 40-plus inch fish just come and stare at the bait, whether it was I think we had like a Cisco belly or something, and then what else? I think we had a mackerel or something like that down there, and I mean, it could depend on the fish too, but yeah, I have 10, 20 minute videos of it just staring, swimming around it staring. But then other times, like when using the live scope, I see a fish come in from 15 feet away and it doesn't stop. It just right in and bang. But I found when they do come in and you're jigging them, if they're just going to look at it, lots of the time they don't hit it. They're just going to stare at it and then they eventually leave. Maybe the difference there is on a set line with it not moving and it being actual food. Maybe that's why they do end up taking it. I'm not too sure, but you would think that, because I've seen lots of videos where people are jigging perch at Buffalo Pound and a pike comes in out of nowhere and just engulfs their hook. Usually smaller ones that'll do it. But it's kind of hit and miss. But I was surprised by that when I had the camera down for the first time too. I'm like, really? Like, are you the most or least active pike in this lake? Like, you watch them in the summer and the way they'll chase things and stuff like that, it's like you would, maybe it is to do with the colder water and stuff. I don't know. I'm not the science guy, but it is pretty cool to watch, but also annoying to watch, because you're like, come on, like, just take it. And you're like, big pike, big teeth, active fish, kind of do your thing. But yeah, I've noticed that as well. Not sure why.
Well, we did do some data collection with Bluetooth sonars, deeper sonar, actually Wi-Fi sonars. And, you know, the information that those provided, you know, we can monitor them remotely. You have your floating sonar underneath the tip-up cover in the hole. And so we could actually see when pike would come and check things out and then leave. And like you're saying, there's days where nothing is happening. And I'm not sure that I really want that data now, because it's like, you know, sometimes you would just wish that there were no fish around and that's why there were no flags going. But the fact that they're always being visited by fish, but they're not biting, is somehow more painful to me than the fact that there might not be any fish at a spot. But anyway,
that's fishing. Like, it's just one of those days, right? It's just how it's going to happen. I mean, there's always fish biting somewhere on the lake, but you're only one group, one person. You only have so much time. And when you're seeing fish there, it's kind of like, well, maybe it's just a matter of time. Maybe once that like lots of times the sun touches the tops of the valley there and all of a sudden the fish start going, like, it's, you never know when it's going to pop off either. So it is almost more annoying to know though, like, there's fish here and they're just not taking the baits today. Then you go back tomorrow and it's one of the best days you've ever had. So it's tough to say. Yeah. I guess with that, do you have off the top of your head some of the biggest fish you're able to land in the study?
The biggest fish in my study was 106 centimeters.
Okay. So is that around that 40, is that 42?
I think 44? It's around 45 inches.
Okay. Okay.
So that was pretty huge. And when you kind of compare it to other animals, like size range, it's about the same length as a full-size golden retriever.
Oh, there you go. That's interesting. No, it's always funny seeing those comparisons as well, or when people try and put the age of something into human years and stuff like that. So no, that's sweet. That's some good fish. And do you care to say what lakes you did these studies on, so people can maybe know that they might catch a tag pike somewhere?
Yeah, of course. So the majority of my research, about, I believe it was 96% of it, was completed on Buffalo Pound Lake, just because of that easy winter access and is pretty consistent ice, which is fantastic for science.
Yep.
And the other, we did a little bit at Boundary Dam, Catepla, Last Mountain Lake, at Sarnia in particular. And yeah, those were the lakes that we looked at. Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. And so this is the last one I'll grill you for. I don't know how long ago it was, but I came out with Shayna and Scott, with you, Chris, on Buffalo Pound to help. And were you guys also recording how many flags went off, but you didn't hook up with the fish? Okay. And so was there kind of a number you found there that was common between all of them? Like, are we talking like 50-50 or what's going on there?
There were more flags that happened that were unsuccessful hookups. Then there were successful hookups or even landing of the fish. I believe we had around a 30% success catch rate. Yeah. So you're going to get a lot of flags, but I'm assuming that's from those fish that are a little bit more selective, tentative when approaching and not taking that hard strike at it and engulfing the bait.
Yeah, and it is difficult too, with especially with buffalo. For every 40 plus inch fish you catch, there's tons in that 30 inch range that are probably just, their eyes are too big for their mouth, and they are just hanging on for dear life to that bait. And then when you do go to set it, it didn't even have the chance, right? And
that
does make it more difficult, especially with bigger baits.
Yeah, we actually have a little bit of a funny story that of a very small pike that decided to try and strike at a tip up, and this was at boundary. And we had a hot dog and a flag went, and we started pulling it up, and the pike was not even close to the hook. It was hanging on for its dear life to the hot dog when we pulled up. We were laughing so hard. It was the funniest thing.
Yeah, they find so much to get caught on with those teeth and their gill rakes too, especially. The day I caught that tag pike that Sunday after the tournament, I started up my truck after we'd set up everything and just to back away, and flag goes off right away, and it was this little pike, and it had it was like children's boxers, like the elastic band of that is all that was left, and that was caught in its gill rake and had kind of formed around it, and that's what caught the hooks. The fish was just driving by basically once I started the truck. I don't know if I scared it or what, but it was flying by the tip up. My buddy brings it up and it's hooked on the elasticized band. It has nothing to do with the bait. There's not even bait anymore. And the fish is just hanging there like half a foot lower, kind of like, what's going on? So I cut that out of it for him and put it back down the hole. But that was a first for me.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of maybe a nice segue to the boundary system, because the, that little pike in boundary just desperate to hold on to that hot dog. That might lead us into Kat's work to talk about boundary in general.
For sure, yeah. We've kept her kind of quiet here, but her time to kind of pop up on the pod here. So I guess I don't know if you both would kind of want to give an overview of what we're looking at here. I don't know as much about this one, so I'll be very interested to kind of see what was going on with this study.
Scott Lake Lodge is the destination trophy fishing location of your dreams. 46-inch trout and 50-inch pike have been caught less than 15 minutes away from the dock. 100 fish days are not uncommon. Fish over 3 million acres of private water and over 500 miles of shoreline. Pair that with some of the best guides in North America and 5-star luxury accommodation. Scott Lake Lodge is a once-in-a-lifetime fishing destination. Check out Scott Lake Lodge on Instagram or Facebook to see what you're missing.
Yeah, I think we'll just turn it over to Kat and let her kind of give an overview, and then she can tell you about some of the specific stuff she thinks is going to be interesting for anglers.
Sounds good.
Yeah, for sure. It's makes sense that you don't know too much about this project yet. It is it's fairly new. Chris started it the summer before I joined the lab as a master's student. So yeah, I came on in January of 22, and have been on it ever since. Yeah, so the interest in boundary came about with the announcement from the federal level that coal-fired electricity is going to be getting phased out across the country. And with that, Boundary Dam Reservoir, it is pretty much constantly pumping a warm water effluent back into the reservoir as just kind of a byproduct of their operations. They use the water from the reservoir for cooling their systems, and then they put it back as a warm water effluent. So that's made a pretty pretty weird and wonderful study site for us. Boundary, for the listeners that aren't familiar, it's south of Estevan, and it's unique in the sense that it doesn't even freeze over fully in the winter near the hot water return. So that's pretty unusual for a Saskatchewan lake. So yeah, that's where the interest in my research came about, was with the announcements of the changes upcoming, and then basically like what's going to happen to that fishery that's been well established for decades.
Right. Yeah, that's, I've heard from lots of people that like they'll be out on Ontario and they say that that's one of their top five destinations as far as bass fishing goes. Maybe not destination, but as far as the fish, the caliber of fish that are in there, they'll come and make trips for that. Like some really high end guys in the fishing industry too. So it's kind of something that you always see stuff about in the Facebook groups and stuff like that, wondering about the bass and whatnot. So What did you end up finding so far with your study?
For sure. Yeah. So I am still in the thesis writing stage. So I don't have everything totally nailed down yet. But something really interesting about Boundary is just the food web in general. So as Chris and Julie were talking about with that little pike hanging onto a hot dog for dear life, that seems to kind of be the story for pike in Boundary. So we used a technique called stable isotope analysis to kind of dig into the food web ecology of Boundary. So one thing that really kind of piqued our interest in the food web was the lack of small fish in Boundary. So, you know, in most lakes, you can catch tons of, you know, fathead minnows, shiners, that sort of thing. And you'll see just schools of them around docks, things like that. But in Boundary, they are super few and far between. So that was something that really got us interested in the food web. So we were like, well, if there's no small fish, like, what are these fish eating in this system? And yeah, something that's really interesting that's come out of it with the pike is that they're, as Julie was talking about, they're thought to be, you know, voracious top predators in basically every system that they're in, except Boundary, it seems, which has been really, really fascinating. So Boundary is unique for a lot of reasons, not just the hot water, but of course, because of the only largemouth bass population in the province. So that means there's three top predators, basically, in Boundary, the pike, bass, and walleye. So we were interested in seeing how those three interact with one another in terms of the food web. So what we found is that bass and walleye are kind of at the same level at the top of okay. the food web, and the pike are down like a whole step, and they it's super interesting. And you know, it just for anyone who has fished at Boundary and caught pike, they maybe would have actually suspected that just based on the condition of the fish. A lot of them are, their head looks too big for their body, basically. They're kind of these noodly looking fish. They're not nearly the same pike that Julie is catching in Buffalo Pound, like those big healthy ones. They're just not like that in Boundary. I'm sure there's a few that are doing okay, but overall the fish, the pike are underweight, and they're kind of struggling in Boundary, which is really interesting and unexpected. Like I said, because they're kind of expected to be at the top of basically every food web they're in.
Right. No, that makes sense. And it's surprising that you say that with like the bait fish and everything, because the very first time I ever went there, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And I was seeing these little schools of fish, and I was like, what are these? And I ended up catching them, and they were bass about the size of my thumb. Like, they were tiny. And that now that you say that, it kind of makes you recognize that other than that, I didn't really see much for smaller fish. They were all just like, they probably were from that year, the fish that I was catching, those, the bass spawn, but it's kind of crazy. And yeah, you don't catch near as many pike there, I find, at least, than compared to walleye. Seem to catch more. It seems like with the way that lake is, for people who know the depth setup of it, it's kind of seems like as soon as you drop off of that shelf into what was probably the main river before or whatever, and then it's to walleye. So when fishing for bass, if you end up getting a bit too deep, that's when we seem to hook up with the walleye, but didn't see much for pike at all there. So that's interesting to know.
Yeah, for sure. Those little bass, they seem to be a pretty important part of the food web. We saw them in the stomach contents of walleye, of other bass, of pike. They seem to be a pretty important food source in a system where there's maybe not that much else to okay. eat. So yeah, super interesting.
So
really cool to see those little guys.
For sure. And so I noticed you're calling it a food web. I know when I was in my science classes, there's always talk about the food chain. Is there a difference between the two, or is that just how science has changed between a food web and a food chain?
A food chain is just a kind of a simplified version of a food web. It would be okay. just, you know, say like
pike and then down a step and then down a step to make a chain. But a food web really incorporates the interactions between everything in the system. So not just focused on, it's less linear, I guess, and more, more complex.
Okay. So basically what I'm picking up is there's not much food other than small bass. So they're all eating turtles.
I didn't sample any turtles in my stable isotope work to look into the food web. And that was maybe an oversight on our end. They could potentially be a food source. Crayfish though are a big one in Boundary. We saw crayfish in stomachs of everything. And there's a ton of them, and they're giant in Boundary. The crayfish are thriving. Pike, not so much. But crayfish seem to be a really important food source there as well. And we did see quite a few frogs in the late season as well. Yeah,
tons and tons of frogs there. And I mean, given the landscape of lots of what's around there too, I mean, it looks like a frog haven. There's so much there for them. But when it comes to focusing on the bass, what did you kind of learn about them there?
Yeah, the bass are, kind of the crowning jewel of Boundary. That's what a lot of people come to Boundary to fish for. I really have grown quite fond of them over the last few years. They're so fun to catch and they're just such cool fish. One really interesting thing that we found with the bass is that they basically are all one size in Boundary. We found a lot of those little guys, like you were talking about, the young of the year, those newly hatched ones, and then a lot in the kind of like 42 to 46 centimeter range. I don't know what that is in inches, sorry.
That'd be around like that 18 mark, 17, 18, I think.
Would it be bigger than that?
42 is about 17.
Okay. Yeah. So
I only guessed that because all the big ones you see caught out of there are always like 17 and a half to like 18, just 18. It seems like in any of the stuff I've seen from there. So I didn't know the conversion. I was just based on the fish I've seen.
Totally. Yeah. And that's super interesting because they are all basically that size. We caught very few, in that like kind of mid-size range. And I think the biggest that we had was around, 50.5 centimeters. So yeah, not sure of that conversion, there, but yeah, they all seem to kind of be within like 4 centimeters of each other, which is super interesting. So what we're thinking with that, is that in a place that is maybe lacking in food is that a lot of those little guys are getting predated on, by bigger fish. And so there isn't actually that many that are able to grow up into adult fish. And so the ones that make it past that kind of mid-size range, they seem to grow up and do well. But that it's a pretty cutthroat place to be a little bass.
Oh, for sure. So basically, if they are able to make it past that stage of being a toddler, something like that, then their chances are pretty good of growing up into those 17, 18 inches. And now that you say that, this is all just making so much sense to me because I always thought like the fish are so skinny here. Like I'm largemouth bass fishing. Why don't they have bellies on them? Like what's going on here? So it kind of does make sense because I have caught some of those bigger ones too. And it's kind of, bass already have kind of big heads and mouths, it seems, but the largemouths at least, but it kind of similar to what I saw in the pike as well. Their heads just seem a little bit bigger than the rest of their body, or it doesn't seem like proportionate compared to what you see in other fish there. And I've the walleye I didn't find to be as skinny there from my own catching, but they all seem to be kind of like sub like 18 or around that 17-18 inches, like smaller fish kind of thing too. So it kind of all is starting to make sense in my head now. I'm kind of blown away by how there's hardly anything for them to eat as far as bait fish go. And you look at fish in Last Mountain and how every fish seems to be fat there. They've obviously got very good food, and whether it's the Ciscos or the other bait fish, like it's kind of interesting to see how different two water bodies can be that really aren't that far apart.
Well, absolutely. And even like we did a little bit of sampling on Cookson Reservoir by Coronach, and that's another reservoir that's affected by thermal effluent from a power station. Using the same techniques, we were pulling up, you know, hundreds of bat heads in these minnow traps, and then we would go back to boundary, and there would be, like at the end of the season or like at the end of the summer, largely our nets are empty for small fish. There's just seriously lacking.
And do you guys have a theory for that at all? Like, do you think it has to do with some of this hot water? I know it's going in, like you said, to Coronach too, but do you have any kind of theory there for that?
We don't know for sure, obviously, yet, but I really think it's just the heavy predation. The walleye fishery is doing pretty well in boundary. Like you said, they look pretty good. They're pretty healthy. The pike struggling, and the bass that I found kind of range. There's some that aren't doing so good, and then there's some that are doing really well there. I think just the heavy levels of predation, that there isn't much opportunity for fish to grow and reproduce before they get eaten by something bigger.
Right. Well, that makes sense. And this is kind of off the topic of the bass, but I've heard rumors about catfish and stuff like that. Did you guys catch anything in your nets as far as like bullhead or anything like that?
Yeah. So that's super interesting. Like, looking back in historical reports and talking to anglers, they used to be everywhere in there apparently. I saw one in my 2 years of being like on the water every day. I saw one decent size bullhead dead on the dock, and then we caught one, like, Chris, how big was it? Like 2 centimeters long. I thought it was a tadpole.
Literally hatched.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yeah. That was literally it. That's all we've caught for bullhead after 2 summers of intensive netting. So it seemed like they are pretty few and far between now nowadays.
Yeah, so I could see that kind of being, I mean, obviously they're spawning if you caught one that small, but I'm sure they get gulped up pretty quickly as well as a nice snack, right? Just like it seems like with everything in that lake, it's a pretty cutthroat lake by the sounds of it after what I just learned in the last 10 minutes here. With that, I know you can't really tell yet, but the kind of the big question everyone has is, what do you guys think will happen once that plant is shut down?
Yeah, this was a question I get all the time, and was expecting to get it tonight too. Because it's kind of on everyone's mind is what's going to happen to these non-native warmer water fish when there's no more hot water coming in. So this is something that we get asked all the time, and unfortunately our answer is probably frustrating, but we don't know. We don't know yet, and it'll be one of those things that we will just have to kind of follow along. My study was really just kind of to set the stage and get some baseline data so we could see how things change over time. But in the 2 years that I was there, I personally think that the bass will persist. There's a lot of folks out there who think that they're going to go basically belly up like right away. But it is a gradual ramp down it's not like they're just shutting off the hot water all at once. It's a gradual ramp down over the course of like many years. So it'll just slowly get cooler and cooler. And looking at other populations, like bass do exist at similar latitudes in Ontario. There's some even further north in Manitoba, some pockets here and there. So that's a pretty good indication that, you know, that they can survive, and they do live in many lakes that freeze over completely. So, and then one other kind of indicator that I think they're going to do okay is that they're utilizing the whole reservoir. So they are at the very far south end, the furthest they can get away from the hot water input. So, and they're utilizing that area for everything. They're spawning down there, they're building nests. So, and that area is largely unaffected by that hot water. So to me, that's a pretty good sign that that they may persist if they are able to already be using that cooler habitat before it's shut off.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Even when you said you're not sure, I'm like, well, that's better than no, they're going to die. But that's always good to hear. And I guess, like you said, I'll just time will tell with what happens. And I do think that gradual decrease in the usage of the plant will help rather than just one day, bam, done. Right. Like, it's just like, I think of it at least of when you're putting fish in an aquarium with kind of getting them used to the aquarium water, you set the bag in there or whatever, let them get used to that. So that's kind of how I envision it in my mind. I have no reason to back it up with that, but that's kind of what popped into my mind from what you're explaining there. And that's kind of nice to know. The one thing I have to ask you is I found that bass are some of the worst smelling fish I've ever held. Would you agree with that when comparing them to like a walleye? Like, lots of people don't like a pike smell, but I found like it was like almost like a really strong like algae-y kind of smell. I don't know. Maybe it's because of where I was catching them there. That was one of my observations with the first one I held. I didn't smell it. It's just you notice it afterwards.
Well, maybe I'm nose blind, but I definitely didn't notice it. But okay. But Boundary, for those listeners that haven't fished there, it's definitely not the most pristine water body in the province.
No.
But it can be kind of stinky regardless. I didn't notice them being extra stinky. But honestly, like, we were a crew of people out there on a boat all day, every day for like 2 years. So we probably just couldn't even smell it anymore.
Right. Yeah, you got used to it. No, yeah. That makes sense. And it's not like, don't get me wrong, it's not like a total dump there. Like, you can go to areas and you can sight fish these fish. Like, it's clear mm-hmm. water, but definitely when you're casting up around that hot water return, I'm like, what is coming up on my hook right now? Like, this is disgusting. So
yeah.
It definitely changes throughout there. No, sure. that's sweet. That's good. That's good to know. I obviously, with it being, at least to my knowledge, for sure, the only largemouth fishery in the province. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of people will drive long distances in the province to come fish them. So that's kind of a topic that lots of people were curious about. So it's good to know that there is work being put into it. And I think it's interesting that you're able to start this study before things change so that you did have that baseline to compare to. Because otherwise, from that, you could be like, well, this is what we're seeing now, but we're not sure what it was like before. So I think that's going to be some pretty, pretty important work when it comes to that fishery for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we didn't quite catch it right before. They already had started ramping down a little bit before okay. we jumped on, but we're catching it at the beginning for sure, just not right. quite at the very start. So it'll definitely be super valuable information for the future.
For sure. Oh, that's good. Did you have anything to add there, Chris?
Yeah, I'll just add that we started with a 2-year program on Boundary, and this is in partnership with SaskPower and the federal government through the Natural Sciences and Energy Research Council of Canada. So that's how the project is supported. So they, you know, they provide the funds for the research. And just recently, we extended that program for another 4 years. So SaskPower awesome. and NSERC have reinvested basically in that research program and expanding it a little bit so we can do a bit more work on Cookson Reservoir and on Rafferty Reservoir. And Rafferty and Boundary being right next to each other and one being heated and the other one not, it's kind of a really neat, almost like a field experiment. You were talking about fish in aquarium. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the setup there with the two of them. So I just wanted to say that we're really appreciative of the support from SaskPower because that, you know, they run those systems. That's their baby. Mm-hmm. And of course from the federal government as well for that. So it's going to be an exciting time to continue doing that research. And as a fundamental scientist, how often do we get to see a single factor varied in a whole lake ecosystem on a known timescale, right?
Right.
Like if I had put in a proposal that said I wanted to do something to a lake over a 10-year period and manipulate something, then people would say you're nuts, right? The yeah. only way you can do that is if you happen to be in the experimental lakes area in Ontario. But here, you know, we have direct lines of communication with the company, and we know when they're going to be changing conditions in the reservoir, and it's just a super interesting place to work.
For sure.
So I guess the message that I'll leave is just stay tuned for more interesting work on those reservoirs in the south. It's going to be quite a fascinating program, and we are going to expand our work on turtles as well. Kat ended up catching more turtles than fish, I think, in her study on Boundary. And so it does make sense to try to understand how those animals are going to respond to the potential loss of, you know, thermal energy in that system. So lots and lots of cool stuff coming.
Oh, for sure. No, that's that's pretty sweet. And obviously all the tidbits and stuff can be found on your guys' Facebook page, Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group. So that's where I get all my information from. I'm always happy when I am scrolling and find an actual nice thing, good thing to see on Facebook. Something I actually want to pay attention to. So no, that's pretty sweet. And I guess that kind of, I totally forgot about Rafferty. Did you guys find that there's lots of bait in there, or was it kind of similar?
We haven't actually started sampling on Rafferty yet. So I have heard some anecdotal reports from folks who spend some time there that bait fish are not as abundant as you might expect them to be in a reservoir in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. But we haven't actually done any sampling to really get at that yet.
Okay.
And we will start with our first year of sampling, forage fish, the smaller fish community, this year in 2024. So we'll be able to provide some more information there. We did look at the relative weight, so the body condition of walleye coming out of Rafferty, and it is a little bit lower than some other places in Saskatchewan, but not in any way that makes me really concerned.
Okay.
So they're obviously finding something to eat in there, and the walleye fishery is doing well in Rafferty. So, I think things are okay there. We'll just get some more information that we'll be able to share once we have nets in the water.
For sure. And I've already kept you guys for quite a while, but we got a couple viewer questions to go through here. I just wanted to, before we got into that, ask you, Chris, about the invasive Prussian carp. You guys still have that study going on?
Yeah, so we are still actively monitoring through our citizen science program, and we are still doing the odd bit of netting here and there. Much like any other research program, it's all dependent on the availability of funds from supporting agencies. Mm-hmm. And that's been a little bit difficult to generate. So right now we're kind of in a holding pattern while we wait for funding resources, but that fish is going to be a big factor, I think, in our invasive species profile. The last that we sampled was last summer, and we are finding those fish outside of Saskatoon now to the northeast and heading towards, you know, Tobin Lake and possibly into Manitoba through that route.
Oh, wow.
What's going to stop them might be the hydroelectric dams, but we, you know, those are not necessarily a complete barrier. And there are more Prussian carp now. When we put nets in the water, we catch them more often and more life stages, so young, medium, old. So it's clear that they're doing well in Saskatchewan and they are moving around. Mm-hmm. So it's a concerning situation. But we are hoping to do more work, especially related to how they're using habitat around the outflow on the Capel Dam side of Lake Diefenbaker. And that's the gateway basically to the Capel system and then to the United States. So there's a real kind of urgent need to understand whether they're going to be able to escape Diefenbaker through that Capel Dam outlet.
Right. So Prussian carp coming to a buffalo pound near you kind of thing.
That's the situation we don't want to see, but yeah. It may be that is the case.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And I just wanted to mention that quickly, obviously not get as in depth with it, but everyone kind of keep your eye out for them. I've only seen one. I think I reported it to Shayna. This was a couple of years ago in a coulee. Revs as far as I could go with my boat in the end of a coulee on, I think, the north end of Diefenbaker. And sure enough, there is, I'm guessing what would be on their higher end for their size is just floating there dead. And I'm like, what is this? I've never seen this before. It doesn't look kind of like a sucker, but I know it's not just a common carp. And yeah, sure enough, I sent that to her and that's what it was. So they're definitely seeing more of them. I haven't seen many posts about them for a while there. I was seeing people were catching them like crazy. They were targeting them just to try and get rid of them, but haven't seen as much. So I wanted to make mention of that, so people were aware that you guys were still kind of monitoring that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We're still monitoring. We're still interested in sightings. And if people catch them, we're still interested in gathering specimens. So anything to do with Prussian carp, we're still very interested in it and love to hear from folks if they encounter them out there.
Cool. Sounds good. So we'll hop into the viewer questions now. All three of you feel free to chime in if you think you have something to add to it. The first one here is from Logan Cassavant. I hope I said your last name right. I know I said your first name right because we have the same one. They asked, can our stock trout respawn, or not respawn, but can they spawn? Or like, if they can't, what's the reason for that?
Okay, I guess I will take that one. So the stock trout program has a variety of different types of fish that they put in lakes. And I'm not a 100% expert on the different strains that they put out. If you're talking about a standard rainbow trout strain, for example, there's no reason why those fish can't spawn if they have the right habitat and the right access to it. There are some hybrid trout that they make, like tiger trout and splake. Those are purposefully created as sterile hybrids that cannot reproduce.
Okay.
And the reason for that is to give the agency in charge of stocking, wherever that happens to be, in this case, it's Saskatchewan, but this is done all over the place, complete control over how many fish are in a particular body of water. So the term is put and take fishery. So you know you're putting in a certain number of hybrid fish, you know they can't reproduce. And so that gives you a formula for management.
Okay. That makes sense. And that kind of goes into this next question here from Tom Tang. I think we maybe talked about it on our last episode, but he was wondering about a southern Saskatchewan body of water that if we could host smallmouth. And I think last time you said we could, but should we, or something along those lines, right? Depending on the water, on the body of water.
Yeah. So that's a great question. So there's more to it than just, can you put some smallmouth in a body of water and will they survive? So that's the could we versus should we part. The province has tried stocking smallmouth bass historically, and they targeted a number of bodies of water, actually largemouth bass as well. And it turned out that Boundary was the only one that retained its largemouth bass when they were stocked.
Okay.
But smallmouth, they've been stocked in a couple of different lakes. There are still some lakes in Saskatchewan that have smallmouth in them. So you can fish for them here. There's just a couple of lakes that kept their populations. We do have some lakes that probably would be suitable in terms of, you know, water chemistry and conditions. The problem is that smallmouth are not going to be as competitive as other native species. And that's one of the reasons why I think we might see some issues with the largemouth in Boundary as the water cools down and walleye become more dominant. Mm-hmm. You know, the bass will struggle in that competitive relationship. It's not the cold of the water, you know, it's not the temperature change, it's the interactions with other species that might be an issue. Okay. Same thing for smallmouth in other environments. So yeah, we do have some lakes where they could probably do okay. And I've heard a rumor that Lovering Lake north of Moose Jaw was a potential site where they were going to try to put smallmouth in. Mm-hmm. But the question is, should we do that? It's a non-native species. Is it a really admirable target for a stocking program?
Right.
We have non-native stocking programs, obviously, with our trout and the trout ponds, and we usually pick places that are contained. So you have isolated trout ponds. You know, we know that the trout are not going to really get out of there.
Yeah.
With the smallmouth, it would kind of have to be a similar situation where you're going to contain them within a closed water body. And you're going to have almost a stock trout-like fishery for smallmouth. So is that something we really want to get into? Is it worth the expense and the trouble? Or should we facilitate native fish populations instead?
Yeah.
So I don't know the right answer, by the way. I'm just pitching the question.
Oh, for sure.
As something to think about.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes sense there. And I mean, it's everyone always just wants to be able to have the species closer to them, right? But I would say as far as, we're lucky that we're pretty close to Manitoba, stuff like that. You can have an awesome trip also going over there to their lakes that already have stuff. Obviously, it's just a bit more of a trip, right? So I'm sure people would be jacked about that. But like you said, everyone likes to look, not you didn't say this, but everyone likes to look at the good side of things, right? And then like you said, well, what are some of the side effects of what we could have with that too? So no, that's interesting. It's people always... I mean, it kind of makes sense with how much bass are south of us in warmer areas and stuff. And I feel like lots of people don't really think of northern areas with the bass. But like you said, we've got an established population in northern Saskatchewan that I've fished it, and they're doing just fine, it seems. So I guess it could depend on every different body of water. But no, that was one that I was kind of wondering about as well, but thought we'd maybe touched on before. So we'll...
Well, one more thing I'll add there, yep. Logan, just for the, because, you know, biology is my thing. So biology lecture here, I'll try to keep it short, but the region we live in, We don't have, well, not, we have one member of what's called the Centrarchidae family in Saskatchewan, and that is the rock bass in the eastern part of the Capel system.
Yeah.
The rest of the province is devoid of sunfish and bass in that entire family of the Centrarchidae. And that's because this is a cold place, right? Mm-hmm. Our native fish assemblages don't include that family because they're typically more of a warm water group.
Okay.
So is that something that we want to foster, is to try to get these, you know, maybe historically we did it and we have a couple of pockets of these cool fisheries like Boundary or Canudo or the other bass are, you know, maybe we want to try to preserve those and keep them as kind of interesting places to go and check out. But is it something that we want to make of a bigger, broader scale?
Right.
Bringing in a group that really doesn't have the adaptations to be here. You know, that's the big question.
For sure. No, that makes sense. That's nice to know, because I've always kind of wondered about like the sunfish and stuff like that. Like that family of panfish, you don't see it here. And obviously that makes sense why, like you just explained. But once again, head east a little bit into Manitoba and they seem to have way more species than us. But then you're also getting towards Ontario where everything just seems to be warmer or not as cold for as long. So that kind of all checks out there. So I guess this might be a good one for any of you guys to answer. Delaney Chaikowski was wondering if you know of any good resources to help teach young kids about, she says, safe handling practices, but I would also add to that just anything about fish or fisheries.
I guess I'll jump in about the safe handling. I am quite fond of bass now, but I'm a trout person. I love them. But so there's a lot of initiatives that come out about safe trout handling because they're a little more delicate than some of the walleye and things like that. So Keep Them Wet is a really good resource. It's largely focused on trout, and you can find them on social media. I think their handle is just Keep Them Wet. And it's trout focused, but it's a good resource for any fish. So that would be one I would suggest.
Awesome. That'd be good. And I guess there's lots of good YouTube videos and stuff like that too. I would add to that. Thankfully, lots of the YouTubers around our parts are pretty good about, it seems like every other video or whatever, they're talking about safer handling practices. And that's something that we're lucky enough that our generations are kind of focusing on that. We're not holding pike up even by the gills as much anymore, but not holding up by the eyes and whatever, stuff like that, like used to be more common practice, right? So some of it I just consider is maybe common sense. It's just, how would you like to be held kind of thing? But I don't know. I think there's YouTube's pretty good for lots of that stuff too. So I don't know if Julie or Chris have anything else there, if we should hop to our last question here.
No, I'll just add in that, so that Keep Fish Wet program that Kat talked about is a really good one, and it's Canadian in origin. So it comes from Steve Cook's research program out of Carleton in Ontario, and they have lots and lots of good stuff there. In addition to handling, they also have some stuff about air exposure time and about photography and that sort of thing, all of which are great things for anglers of all ages, not just children, to take a look at. But the other thing I would add is that where do most of us learn how to handle fish? Usually somebody in your family teaches you, right? So mm-hmm. You go fishing with grandpa or whatever. So I think the onus is on people who have a lot of experience angling to stay up to date on these kinds of things and to pass that knowledge on to the next generation as they show them how to fish.
Yeah.
And so those techniques that you were talking about, you know, grabbing pike by the eyeballs or, you know, that sort of thing. Those practices should be phased out, and that, you know, people should be staying educated on what the best practices are.
Yeah.
And actually a good place to get that kind of information is even just in the Saskatchewan Angler's Guide, right? They have some guide steps there, some best practice recommendations for catch and release. And theoretically everybody should be looking at that guide at the beginning of the season. So, you know, that's a good place to get some information as well.
Yeah, for sure. And we're not saying go on to someone's comments on Facebook and tear them apart for holding the fish bad. I know I made the mistake of trying to be nice with those ones, and just like, you don't know how experienced someone is, right? And so you try and help educate, and then you can't tell tone over text or whatever, right? So that can blow up. We're not saying to rip people about it. Just it's good to hand down the knowledge that you have as well. Because like you said, yeah, it's usually your dad or your grandpa or whatever that took you out fishing for the first time. And that's how they grew up knowing how to do it, whatever it was 30, 40 years ago, and things change, luckily for the better for this. So I think that's some good suggestions there for Delaney. I know she's got two young ones coming up. Delaney's actually one I was telling you about earlier, that her and her husband won the burbot category for adults with the 38 and the 36. And then their daughter won the youth burbot category with like a 31 and a half or something. So they,
the burbot family, that's my favorite species. So I'm jealous.
There you go. And, this is, I think we should be okay. I don't know if you're just going to take this one, Chris, because it's about regulations here, but
sure.
This one just deals with, what are your thoughts on regulations where no big fish are kept at all? This is, I think, pertaining to, this is from Chris Ross. I think it's pertaining to some of Manitoba's newer regulations, but he says, thoughts on regulations where no big fish are kept, only small ones.
Yeah, this is a whole area of fishery science called size-based management, and it is a complicated beast to, there's a very strong interplay between the pressure that a system receives, so how much harvest is being done for particular size ranges, and then how that's going to play out, and also what the goals of the fisheries management are. So it's really a difficult question to address broad spectrum. And sometimes, for example, we'll get suggestions that every lake should have a slot, protected slot on it, right? So you can harvest fish that are below a certain size and above a certain size, but not in the middle. And it's really hard to come up with a blanket size management strategy like that because of that problem I just mentioned of, you know, each lake is going to respond somewhat differently in terms of the pressure and the growth rates and the age at first reproduction, that kind of thing. In general, the idea is that the biggest fish are going to be the most valuable for reproduction. So the strategy in Manitoba is leave those big fish entirely alone and stick to the young ones. So the idea there being you foster as much reproduction as possible, and therefore you're going to produce more of those small fish that people are then harvesting.
Right.
So that's the philosophy. In principle, it's a good idea because, you know, like we said, we want to maximize reproductive output. If you have a system that's really, really heavily exploited and you're getting a ton of harvest, you might see what's called a recruitment bottleneck where you're not going to get enough small fish passing through and getting into that large fish category. But in a place like Manitoba, I'm guessing that that's probably not going to happen just because the population size is not big enough. You know, some places in the States where they have 10 or 15 times more anglers than we have fishing the same body of water, it might be a bigger issue.
Right.
So just to recap, I know I did a lot of mumbling there. I think the general philosophy of fostering good reproduction, preserving those large individuals that do the best reproduction, that is a good strategy. But there is some nuance to making it play out for what you want in your fishery.
Right. And I guess I'll add in there that I learned in our last episode that we did, I don't know if it was 31 or 32, but I learned that fish just keep getting better with age, right? I always thought that once they got to a certain age, it would kind of peter off and they wouldn't be as good at reproducing. But if I'm not mistaken, you said that they just keep, or maybe don't keep getting better, but they remain good producers, right? Or reproducers.
Yeah. A big fish is always better than a small fish at reproduction, regardless of how old that fish is.
Okay. So I know I've talked to quite a few people about that, especially since I've learned that from you, and they kind of had the same idea I originally had. So I think that's a common thought out there that might be the case, but I think some people are maybe upset. I know that actual mounts aren't as common anymore. Lots of people get replicas, but I know I've heard lots of people say, well, that's kind of the reason that if it is like a red zone that you can keep those trophy fish, because then you can actually put it on your wall like people used to do more commonly. But with the way replicas are now and stuff like that, and they last longer, I think it just makes more sense that you can release that fish now and just take your measurements and photos and stuff like that, and you're good to go. So that would be my only reason I've already told myself I wouldn't do that with a real fish, but that would be the only reason I could think of to keep a fish of that size.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, Tobin Lake in Saskatchewan is a great example. It has that protected slot where that's 86 centimeters for walleye. I mean, imagine if you caught an 86.5 centimeter walleye. Mm-hmm. That fish is going to be 30 plus years old. And, you know, killing it to put it on a mount to me seems like, you know, it's something I would not personally do. And it sounds like you would not do it either.
No.
So it, you know, the replica is the way to go. And, you know, the idea that you can harvest that fish, you know, but I don't think anybody will.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think as more time passes and that philosophy and that knowledge about large fish gets more widespread, fewer and fewer people are going to want to take those really big fish, you know, and kill them anyway. So yeah,
for sure. No, that makes sense. I've even gone as far as saying, like, when my buddies were out not catching anything and just talking about if you to catch a world record size fish. And I'm like, I think I'd be kicking myself if I killed it. So I said I would put it back and just know that it was, because I was like, that's knowing that I would be killing that fish is like kind of like, well, now there is no more record for that kind of thing, right? For the potential for it to get bigger and stuff too. So that one, it's hard to say, right? You can, until you're in the moment, but I even took it another step farther of, even if it was maybe a world record or provincial record kind of thing, I wouldn't want to keep it. Maybe in like the instant I would want to, but then after, like right after it was dead, I'd be like, I don't think I wanted to do that. So that's how far I take it. But
yeah, I think taking some measurements and a couple of good photos and putting it back that would be enough for me. But yeah. I mean, you know, different anglers have different views on it, and some might want to harvest, you know, and as long as it's legal to do so, you know, that's their right to do that.
Yeah.
But you know, Manitoba has taken the stance that, you know, every fish in that, you know, above a certain size range is important. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's just like talking about what you do if you won the lottery. Neither are probably going to happen, so we don't got to worry about it anyways. But
right.
Yeah. No, I've really enjoyed this. That was lots of really interesting stuff. I think the listeners will have enjoyed it as well, and I've kept you guys longer than I intended as well, so I should be letting you go here. But where can we find all this stuff, whether it's like the papers or just like the tidbits? We already mentioned the Facebook and stuff, but maybe just let everyone know where they can find you and stay up to date with everything.
Yeah, so the Facebook page is where we put most active information out. So that's the Saskatchewan Sportfish Research Group on Facebook. I also have some information on publications on my website, which is summersbiology.ca. And we do have a Twitter page, but I don't really keep that one up to date very well. So not such a great place to go. But people can always email me as well at chris.summers@uregina.ca if they have any questions or any cool observations. You know, they're always game to chat that way.
Awesome.
And I can also put people in touch with Kat and Julie if they want to ask them some specific questions about their work.
Awesome. That works good. I appreciate all three of you coming on, taking the time at our evening. I know Julie is still sitting at the school, so I'm sure you've had a long enough day there, but I really appreciate you three taking the time to come on today.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
There you have it. Another episode in the books with the Saskatchewan Sportfish Research Group. Hope you found this one just as interesting as I did. I know I found the differences between the single, double, and triple trebles really interesting, as well as the circle hooks. I've kind of always wondered that, but it's nice that they're able to actually put that to the test. I found it pretty interesting that there wasn't really too much of a difference in the hookup rates. It was more in the placement of the hookup and everything like that. It's definitely something that I've been looking at over the last couple March Madness seasons, if you will. And I think I'll be definitely trying out more of the single treble, obviously depending on the size of my bait. Sometimes I'm using big mackerel that I feel like it's kind of necessary to have the two trebles there, but using herring or small Cisco, stuff like that, can't go wrong with that single treble. So definitely some cool stuff there. And then with that boundary information, I was blown away that they were finding hardly any bait fish and whatnot in the water there, and found it really interesting that most of those fish were chomping on crayfish and stuff like that. So that's definitely something to keep in mind if you're heading down there in the next little while, throwing some crayfish patterns and stuff like that, whether that's on cranks or in your soft plastics. But really interesting stuff there. It'll be cool to see kind of what happens as things start to change more and more in that water there. But obviously from this episode, you know that the Sportfish Research Group will be there doing their studies throughout that time. Really hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Just want to give a quick shout out again to 13 Fishing for being our presenting sponsor. Head over to their website, use code Weekend Warriors, save yourself 15% at checkout. And by the time we have next episode coming out here, we'll be one day away from open water season opening up again here in southern central Saskatchewan. So we'll be looking forward to that, and we'll see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to leave a review on your favorite listening platform so we can reach more anglers just like you. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube for media updates and behind-the-scenes content.